If you would turn in your Old Testaments to 1 Kings chapter 20. 1 Kings 20, we'll be engaging in a study this morning that starts there in 1 Kings 20, and we hope to make some helpful application as we consider the will of God this morning. You might remember a couple of weeks ago, we studied from 1 Kings chapter 22, and we looked at that entire chapter in some detail when Ahab sought an alliance with Jehoshaphat, and they came together against Syria, and there was the consulting of false prophets and then true prophets, and Ahab and Jehoshaphat both believed a lie, and we talked about the anatomy of rejecting the truth. Well, leading up to that study, we set the context about the conflict between Syria and Israel at the time, and we looked at a place in 1 Kings chapter 20 where we saw an interesting verse, an interesting phrase, I think a powerful one, and I want to think about that a little bit this morning. In 1 Kings chapter 20, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, besieged Samaria, but God gave the Israelites victory against his advances. In verses 1 through 4, he surrounded Samaria and sent messengers in to Ahab, making some demands, and he complied. And then he doubled down on that and made even more severe demands. And Ahab consulted the elders, and they counseled against him accepting those terms. And so when Ahab refused, Ben-Hadad threatened even further in verses 10 through 12. He said, "The gods do so to me, and more also, if enough dust is left of Samaria for a handful for each of the people who follow me, I'm going to raise it. I'm going to destroy you." And then it's interesting how Ahab responded. "Tell him, let not the one who puts on his armor boast like the one who takes it off. You act as though the battle is completed and we haven't even started." And so God sent a prophet to Ahab, and the prophet told him that God would deliver him from Ben-Hadad and the Syrians. They would gain victory. And the Israelites made their move according to the will of God on the Syrians and gained victory that day. But then that prophet told Ahab that Ben-Hadad would attack again in the spring. That's where I want to begin reading there in verse 23 of 1 Kings chapter 20. It says in 1 Kings 20 in verse 23, "Then the servants of the king of Syria said to him, 'Their gods are gods of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we. But if we fight against them in the plain, surely we will be stronger than they. So do this thing: dismiss the kings, each from his position, and put captains in their places. And you shall muster an army like the army that you have lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot. Then we will fight against them in the plain. Surely we will be stronger than they.' And he listened to their voice and did so. So it was in the spring of the year that Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were mustered and given provisions, and they went against them. Now the children of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of goats, while the Syrians filled the countryside. Then a man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, 'Thus says the Lord, because the Syrians have said the Lord is God of the hills, but he is not God of the valleys. Therefore, I will deliver all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord.' And they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. So it was that on the 7th day, the battle was joined, and the children of Israel killed 100,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians in 1 day. But the rest fled to Aphek, into the city. Then a wall fell on 27,000 of the men who were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and went into the city, into an inner chamber." We are impressed when we read accounts like this. And if something like this were to have happened in modern military warfare and perhaps even just recent military history, it would be something that is talked about all the time, especially when you think about how many foot soldiers were killed, but then a wall fell on a bunch of others. it is quite apparent that there was supernatural activity that was a part of this conflict. God made sure that these people and his people knew that you don't undermine my power. You don't question my ability. You don't raise yourself up against me in arrogance and act as if my people militaristically will be inferior and impotent in comparison to your mere human efforts. The Israelites were not strong because of their military power. They were not strong because of their brains, because of their advancements in that kind of scholarship and a military level. They did not go to school to study military sciences and to make sure they knew different tactics and were able by their own strength to conquer these kinds of people and these nations. The reason the Israelites always gained victory was because God determined to deliver them from the hands of their enemies. He determined to deliver their enemies into their hands and to ensure their victory. And so I want us to be impressed, especially by the way the Lord put it in verse 28. He said, because they say the Lord is God of the hills, but he is not God of the valleys, I will deliver all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. It doesn't matter if we fight in the mountains or if we fight in the plain. It doesn't matter if we fought on the moon. God will gain the victory if he wants it. And the only reason the Israelites ever failed in these kinds of settings was due to their own unfaithfulness to God, or how presumptuous they were before a battle, advancing when God had not given instructions, when they did not act by his will and authority. It's the only reason they ever failed. That's the only reason the Jews as a nation do not exist to this day, because God had promised an eternal kingdom for them, that the throne would persist, that they would continue to prosper as long as they were faithful. And the reason they were led into captivity, the reason the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians and then by the Romans, was because of their rejection of God. But every time God was on their side and was there fighting for them, not with them, but for them, they gained victory. I believe that this can be illustrative of how God is in our lives. There are times when we might describe our lives as being on the mountaintop. Things are going excellently, whether it be spiritually or physically. We're prospering in various ways. Our job is good. Our family's good and thriving and getting along. Or we're growing spiritually. We're figuring things out. We've accomplished understanding a very difficult passage we've struggled with for years. Or we've been tempted with this certain thing for days and days and days. And we've prayed and prayed and we've gained victory. We did not succumb. When we're on the mountaintop, it's because God has been with us and he needs to be acknowledged for such. But there are countless times in our lives that we will be in the valley of the shadow of death, as Psalm 23 puts it. And in those low times, those difficult circumstances, those sorrowful circumstances, God is who we depend on and we need to turn to him. There are those who in those valleys of life tend to actually lose faith completely in God. They come to the false conclusion that because they are in the valley, it means God doesn't care. And that he, if he was powerful, would have lifted them up by now. But if he hasn't, he obviously isn't powerful enough. Maybe he doesn't even exist, and they turn away from him. And so in either circumstance, whether we're on the hill or in the valley, there are going to be temptations to forget about God, to turn our backs on God, when in reality, in both circumstances, there is ample opportunity for us to bring glory to him and to magnify him and to show the world just how wonderful and powerful and loving and gracious that our God is. I want us to consider some examples of this in the lesson this morning. Consider firstly that God is indeed God of the hills. I want us to look at a passage in Isaiah where we read about the continuation of Israelite history, especially when it was concerning the days of the king Ahaz. You might remember in Isaiah chapter 7, by inspiration, Isaiah is describing the period of Israelite history of what has been termed the Syro-Ephraimitic Uprising. We remember the great threat, the world threat at this time was the notorious nation of Assyria. They were very barbaric and gruesome in the way that they treated their enemies. They did not just defeat them militaristically, but they completely embarrassed them and demoralized them and humiliated them and tortured them. And they were one of the first that partook in psychological warfare, shock and awe. They treated their enemies in this way so that the rest of the people would fear them and yield to them before they would have to force their submission. And so you can understand that Syria and Israel, the northern nation here, are struggling when the threat of Assyria comes against them. In verses 4 through 9, though, Isaiah in Isaiah 7, verses 4 through 9, is sent to Ahaz to tell him that he need not worry about this. He doesn't need to join the alliance of Syria and Israel as they were forcing him to do. And so this is what the scripture tells us in Isaiah 7, verse 4. Take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah, because Syria and Ephraim and the son of Remaliah have plotted evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabal. What was happening is Syria and Israel joined forces. They wanted Judah to join as well. And in order to force their hand, they were going to set up a puppet king. And what God is telling Ahaz through Isaiah is, don't worry about that. It's going to fail. They can't do this. He continues in verse 7, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass, for the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. He's saying that's the only place he's going to rule over. Syria is not going to be ruler over Judah. He's not going to have control over Judah. His rule is going to be limited to Damascus. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken. They'll be led off into Assyrian captivity. It will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. His only place of rule is going to be Israel. You don't have to worry about him in Judah. He says, if you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Isn't that always the case? If you don't believe me, then I'm not going to protect you. That's why the people of God fail from time to time. And that's exactly what Ahaz did. He manifested unbelief. So in verse 17, the Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah. It's going to get really bad for you because you didn't believe in me. But it's not going to be Syria and Israel. It's going to be Assyria, the main threat. And so he prophesies in chapter 8 and verse 6. Inasmuch as these people refuse the water of Shiloh and that flow softly and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son, verse 7. Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty, the king of Assyria in all his glory. He will go up over his channels and he will go over all his banks. He will pass through Judah. He will overflow and pass over. He will reach up to the neck. And the stretching out of his wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. He's saying, because you did not trust in me, Assyria is going to take Judah. The only thing that he's not going to take is Jerusalem, up to the neck. The head of Judah is Jerusalem. Because you did not believe in me. But this is God using Assyria. And so that's what I want us to focus on. When we get to chapter 10, the prophet is speaking about Assyria's attitude. You see, their victory was allowed by God and used by God to judge sinful nations and his own sinful people. They didn't realize that. And so the prophet says in Isaiah 10 and in verse 12, therefore it shall come to pass when the Lord has performed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his haughty looks. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it. And by my wisdom, for I am prudent, And I have removed the boundaries of the people and have robbed their treasuries. So I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. My hand has found like a nest the riches of the people. And as one gathers eggs that are left, I have gathered all the earth. And there was no one who moved his wing nor opened his mouth with even a peep. He's saying this is all happening because we're just really strong and powerful. God has nothing to do with it. In fact, in verse 7, he had said, he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so that God is using him. He doesn't think it's because God's using him. He thinks it's all because of his talent and ability and power. So notice in verse 15, these powerful words, shall the axe boast itself against him who chops with it? Or shall the saw exalt itself against him who saws with it, as if a rod could wield itself against those who lift it up, or as a staff could lift up as if it were not wood? Therefore the Lord of hosts, will send leanness among his fat ones, and under his glory he will kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. So the light of Israel will be for a fire and his Holy One for a flame. It will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and it will consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body. And they will be as when a sick man wastes away. The rest of the trees of his forest will be so few in number that even a child may write them. And so God would destroy Assyria, would bring them low, because on the mountaintop they had no thought for God. They did not even entertain the thought that the God who created them of the universe was in control of this situation. They were conquering his people. And it was because they were more powerful than him. And God says, that's not how it works. You are merely a tool in my hand, is basically what verse 15 is saying. And brethren, we need to understand that. I know that this is a wicked nation, but we need to understand that when we gain success, when people have listened to us as we taught the gospel and they have obeyed, it's not for our glory. This has nothing to do with our ability. God forbid that we should forget that he's the power behind all that we're trying to accomplish. And if we do forget, he'll bring us low. He is God of the hills. We see another negative example of this in King Saul. You remember in 1 Samuel chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8, that Israel grew tired of the current system of the judges, namely because Samuel's sons were abhorrent. They were not judging properly. They were immoral. They were not being those that God would call them to be. And so they demanded a king, and Samuel gets upset and he says, wait a second, they didn't reject you, they've rejected me. And so in 1 Samuel chapter 10, in verse 1, Saul is anointed, is chosen to be the first king of Israel. And in chapter 11, he finds military success when he delivers Jabesh Gilead from the Ammonites. And I want us to notice in verse 13 of 1 Samuel chapter 11, the kind of mindset that he finds himself in. He says, today the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. This is where Saul is at this point in history. He is on the mountaintop. He is king. He has found success. And he realizes God has delivered them into our hands. He has gained us victory. But then just a chapter over, in chapter 13, when they were struggling against the threat of the Philistines, and Samuel had, by God, appointed a time where he would come and make a sacrifice for the Lord's favor, that Saul grew impatient because of the threat of the Philistines. And instead of waiting by faith, waiting on the Lord, which the Bible is replete with examples of and encouragement toward, he acted presumptuously and made the sacrifice himself. In verse 9, he said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. And then Samuel said in verse 13, you have done foolishly and not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he has commanded you. Now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but your kingdom shall not continue. And then we get to chapter 15. And we might think Saul was going to learn his lesson, that I'm not gaining this success. I'm not being the effective king because of me, but it's because of God. But he didn't. And so when God told him in 1 Samuel 15 to utterly destroy the Amalekites from the face of the earth, women and children and their king and the men and the military and even their animals, don't leave anything else. Saul again acted presumptuously and spared the king and the best of the flocks to offer to God. You remember Samuel's powerful words in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 15. When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? Did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? See, that's the point. When we're on the mountaintop, we need to still be little in our own eyes. We need to recognize how small we are in the grand scheme of things, and how we pale in comparison to the glory of God. And glory needs to go to Him always by maintaining faith. You see, Saul claimed to have done something good for the Lord. I spared the flocks to offer a good sacrifice to you. And we remember Samuel's words later on in verse 22. Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, He has also rejected you from being king. We need to maintain faith even in the greatest heights of success in our life. We can never forget God. We must always be humble, even in the times when we're exalted, knowing that it is the Lord and only the Lord that got us to that point. Let us not rationalize going against God's will because we think our wisdom is wiser than His. We need to maintain that littleness in our eyes and exalt God on the mountaintop with faithfulness. But then we have a good example in David. David was that man after God's own heart spoken of in chapter 13, whom God would replace Saul with. He's anointed king in chapter 16. In chapter 17, there is the famous story of this little shepherd boy defeating the great champion of the Philistines, Goliath. And we remember the mindset of David in that time, that you come to me with a spear and a sword, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts. He's the God of Israel that you are trying to scorn and mock, and He's going to defeat you. And with the sling and stones, He defeated this great champion and decapitated him with His own sword. In chapter 18, he continued to have military success after Saul appointed him to a place of military honor, and the women sang that David slayed his 10,000s, or Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. That made Saul angry and he tried to kill him. And so this is where David is essentially on the mountaintop. He's not necessarily in the official place of king yet, but Saul knows that he's been rejected, that there's another man that is going to be replacing him. And this David is having all kinds of success, and it's quite obvious that God is with him. And so when we get to chapter 24 of 1 Samuel, on the mountaintop, David has an opportunity by his power to kill this man who is filled with pride and is trying to bring him low. And in verses 3 through 7 of 1 Samuel 24, while he was in a cave and Saul was seeking him and went into that same cave, the men of David said to him, "This is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, that you may do to him as it seems good to you.' And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And then he said, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing that he is the anointed of the Lord.'" He'd have another opportunity in chapter 26 of 1 Samuel to go into the camp of Saul while they were sleeping and kill him again. And he said simply, essentially the same thing. "Do not destroy him," verse 9. "For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" What David is saying is that, listen, I didn't get this far by taking matters into my own hands. I do not have the authority to do this. God, he goes on to describe, he'll take care of Saul in whatever way he wishes. If he told me to do this, I would do this. But it may be that he takes care of him in some other way. But he's the God of this mountaintop, and I'm not going to turn my back on him now. We know David had his faults, but this is illustrative of how we should be when we are on the mountaintop. But God is also the God of the valleys. I want us to remember how the Israelites came into power and greatness. We remember that, of course, Joseph rose to power in Egypt after his brother sold him into slavery, and God used him in that position of power to provide for his people in famine. They were few at the time and turned to Egypt in a desperate time of need, lest they perish from the face of the earth. And because of Joseph's wisdom and God working through him, there was provision not just for the Egyptians, but also for the Israelites. And they preserved their lives that day and stayed there and multiplied and began to be a very great nation. Exodus 1 begins saying that they increased abundantly and were fruitful and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. So you already see a time of desperation with the children of Israel and their closeness to demise and the famine and how few they are. And God is bringing them up out of that valley because God's in control in the valley. But then in Exodus 1, when they're growing and multiplying, we're very familiar that a Pharaoh rose who did not know Joseph like the other did and started treating the Israelites very severely. And they were slave drivers toward them, and they made them suffer and killed their male children. And by the grace of God, the parents of Moses spared his life, and he would deliver the children of Israel from the hands of Pharaoh. In chapter 3 and verse 7, this is what the scripture tells us. The Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrow. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up from that land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. In Exodus 19, we see after that great victory that he told them he would make them a great and holy nation if they followed him. God is God of the valley. There's never a circumstance that is so unfortunate and that is working so much against us that God cannot reverse it and bring us blessings physically and spiritually. And we need to realize that and have faith in him in those times of depression and loneliness in the valley. We see one of those Israelites in later history as we go back to the context of 1 Samuel. Hannah, who found herself in a very low valley. A woman like most women, if not all women, who desired a child but could not have a child. In fact, Elkanah, her husband, had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And Peninnah could bear children, and so Peninnah was not gracious to Hannah. She did not sympathize with her and treat her fairly, but took advantage of the situation and treated her very, very poorly. Hannah was tortured by Peninnah every single day. It says in verse 6, her rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. So it was year after year she went up to the house of the Lord. She provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. To add fuel to that fire and salt to that wound that was already so difficult to bear of not being able to have children, Peninnah made her remember it every day. She was in the valley for sure, but she turned to God. I want us to notice in verse 9 of the text, verse 11, she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head. And in the valley, she remembered God is God of the valley, and she turned to God. She cast her cares upon God. She asked God to do the impossible. It tells us that God heard her prayer. In verse 19, Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. And she did what she said she would do. God is God of the valleys, brethren. And I want us to notice Hannah's prayer because it is replete with this concept that God is God of the hills. And if you don't acknowledge him as that, he'll bring you low. But he's also God of the valleys. And if you turn to him in dependence, he'll bring you up. He will help you in time of need. This is what Hannah prayed in 1 Samuel 2 and verse 1. My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn or strength is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies. because I rejoice in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumble are girded with strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne seven, and she who has many children has become feeble. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and brings up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He makes low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the beggar from the ash heap to set them among princes and make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. From heaven he will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Filled with it, that God will bring down those who are arrogant and have exalted themselves like Peninnah and all the others we've seen. And for those who are brokenhearted and contrite and turn to God in time of need with full dependence and faith in his ability, he will lift them up. And brethren, that goes not just physically, but especially spiritually. There are times when we have failed and we have sinned and are broken before him, and we feel like we've messed up so bad that there is no way we can recover. God can lift you up. He can restore you to faithfulness. So we have a negative example with Job's wife, who didn't realize that God is also God of the valleys. We remember very well the story that is famous of Job and his sufferings when the Sabians raided and took away his oxen and donkeys and killed his servants. And then at that same time, a fire burned up the sheep and servants, and the Chaldeans raided and took away his camels and killed his servants. And then a great wind struck the house where his children was, and it fell on them and they all died. But what Job did in verse 20 of Job 1 is he arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshiped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." He knew God was the God of the valleys as well. When he says, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," he's speaking well of God and his character and his love and his grace and his mercy toward the people who are righteous before him and follow him in faith, even though the most righteous man there is at the time is suffering in unheard of, unprecedented ways. God is God of the valleys. But when Satan struck his person with boils and Job sat in sorrow and pain and scraped them with potsherds, Job's wife manifested she did not have faith that God was God of the valley. She said in verse 9 of chapter 2, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." How dare we magnify and glorify God when he, by his power and love, gives us victory and blessings, and question his goodness and ability when Satan afflicts us and causes us harm? How dare we? It's basically what Job told her. "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. The examples could go on and on, but we need to learn from them. I want to tell you what we learned from 1 Kings 20 and verse 28 and the passages we looked at and the plethora of passages that we could have looked at is that everything good comes from God. James 1 and in verse 17 says as much. Everything good and perfect is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. We need to realize that. Everything good that we have, physically or spiritually, it all comes from him. There's not a thing that we have that is worthwhile that does not come as a result of God's grace and love and kindness. When we're in a time of prosperity or happiness or success, we need to give him the glory. We need to maintain that humility in our own eyes and resolve to strengthen our faith in him. Not assume that our faith is already strong enough and that's why we are where we are. We are where we are because of his unmerited favor. And that should bolster our faith. But also, we need to realize that He is the solution to all our problems. Just recently, I sent out an article for our bulletin from Lamentations 3, where the children of Israel have been afflicted by the Babylonians because of their unfaithfulness. The temple is destroyed, and they are completely and utterly helpless and weeping. And that's what Lamentations is about. It's basically some funeral dirges for the people of God in His city. But this is what Jeremiah ended up doing. He remembered that God is God of the valleys, that He's the solution to our problem. He definitely has punished us because of our unfaithfulness, but He is also the very solution to that. And so he says in Lamentation 3 and verse 19, "Remember my affliction in roaming." He's telling God, the wormwood and the gall, "My soul still remembers and sinks within me." He's laying his cares on God. "This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. Because I'm casting my care upon you, the God of the valleys, I have hope. Through the Lord's mercies we are not consumed, because His compassions fail not. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness." He's saying even in this time of destruction and sorrow, there is God's presence in the form of blessings and faithfulness. "The Lord is my portion, my soul," says my soul, "therefore I hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the soul who seeks Him. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord." God is the solution to all our problems. And with all of that, we need to remember that He resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. Don't you ever forget that. God is in control of people, of families, of nations, of churches. He will humble the proud. But if we maintain fidelity to Him and realize how small we are, He will exalt us. James says in James 4 and verse 6, "He gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up." The reverse is true as well. Exalt yourself in the sight of the Lord, and he will bring you down. We need to realize that God is powerful and is in control to our benefit. No matter where we are in our life, no matter what is going on, as long as we realize who He is and glorify Him, magnify Him, and maintain faith before Him and obedience. Before we dismiss to our classes, we'll be led with a closing word of prayer.